He's going to be on.
All right. I'm going to talk a bit about embedded software development. What? Is that a... or just too far away? I'm Ethan Cully. I'm the principal software engineer at Arcadis, a fabless semiconductor manufacturer based in Piscataway. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the process of producing embedded software, particularly as regards our chip, because it's obviously what I'm most experienced with. I don't think embedded software development is a particularly well-defined idea, so the first thing is to say what I think it means, and then we'll move on from that point. I think that I don't make it a hard distinction between embedded software development and software development for open systems. Rather, I consider them basically endpoints on a continuum. Deeply embedded into the continuum, we have there's a very limited access to the software controlling the hardware platform, and the hardware platform itself is very fixed and rigid. Whereas at the open end of the platform, the hardware there's a lot of flexibility. Users can control what the hardware environment is and what the software running on that hardware is. As an example here, a bunch of things I more or less picked out as random and arranged left to right as concerns how embedded or open I consider the platform to be. There's essentially, you can quibble with this. I'm not expert on many of these things, but there's essentially no ability to modify the firmware of the software on Ethernet hub, and you can take apart and reassemble the firmware on the hardware on desktop PC as much as you like. The embedded platforms are different than open platforms, primarily because duplicating a piece of embedded software is not particularly useful on its own. You also need to duplicate the associated hardware platform. The Free Software Foundation, you all know, was basically created on the idea that copies are essentially free. That's not the case. In the embedded environment, because the software can't be usefully separated from the associated hardware, and the hardware copies are much more expensive than software copies. Hardware costs, therefore, are extremely important to the business building embedded applications, so we try to design in the cheapest hardware that we can that can support our applications. This often, but not always, will mean that our hardware will be very limited relative to what we're used to on desktops. And that means that the software is also quite a bit more limited compared to what we're used to on desktops. Now, some of the limitations of the embedded software include things like the debugging environment. It's very difficult to get the same sorts of runtime debuggers in an embedded environment that we're used to having in the open systems on the development PC. For example, I've recently tried to attach a debugger to a running DSP. Extremely fragile. The software is not really well built for being able to switch between DSPs, at least the software that I was using. You have to hand edit certain configuration files in order to get it to run. And then once it does, hopefully you've got the reset line in the right position and that sort of thing, where things will just happen properly.
Any
hardware chip will probably have a reset line usually an inverted reset line that when it's low will tell the hardware to reset its state to the initialization parameters, and then when it goes high start executing or start running normally. You may or may not have address space separation on the embedded platform. In other words, everything may or may not have to live within a single process. The correlate of that is that you may or may not have memory protection in the embedded system. You can scribble over critical system memory, and there's really nothing to prevent you from doing that. Threading support is often very limited in certain embedded systems. The one that I mostly work with does have a decent preemptive threading library that we've worked with, for example, a programmable integrated circuit where everything runs in super loop architecture, basically polling driven, polling answer driven, and no multiple threads. Even if you have, even if you do include threads in your application, the threads are, the thread library may be much less sophisticated than what you're used to on a desktop at this point. You may not have counting semaphores, binary semaphores, queues, mutexes, thread level storage. Dependency inversion may be a problem. And you may not have preemptive multithreading, you may just have cooperative multithreading. The scheduler may be extremely, even if you do support threads, then it could be an extremely limited support of threads. We tend to avoid dynamic memory allocation as much as we can in the embedded environment because we tend to design things to run kind of steady state applications as opposed to ask the application to do this thing and get a result and then I don't care about the application anymore. So therefore we try and have things that avoid operations that can fail partway through, such as calling malloc and free, malloc can fail and then you have to insert a whole recovery path for that. It's more difficult than it's worth in a lot of applications. We don't necessarily have file systems. Even if we do have a file system, we may not be able to write to it. Certain language constructs won't always work. There's an embedded C++ variant of a subset, I should say, of the C++ programming language, which is explicitly designed to be stored and to be used for embedded applications. It has things like avoids the use of immutable keyword because immutable keyword prevents const variables from being ROMable, in other words, being able to be stored in read-only memory. There are other things that also don't necessarily work. For example, initialization parameters global variables use initialization values refer to other global variables don't necessarily work. If you're found that read-only position independent data.
Isn't that true with global variables in general in C++, where you don't know the order of initialization, so you can't refer to
global
variables?
That's probably true for non-plain old data variables in C++, but plain old data, I think, would probably be okay. Actually, that's probably not true. Yeah. If you have constructors, yes, then you'll probably have problems, and you could very well have problems, but you don't necessarily have the same sorts of constructors. You can have global variables in C that refer to each other. Therefore, by restricting yourself to those types of initialization constructs, you can almost certainly do it in C++ as well.
So it's only a problem with the constructor.
Well, one thing that's going on is we can call in constructors out of a reset or prior to the main entry point in an application in C++. You need to explicitly create the support to do that in your operating system or in your environment if you're not using one of the off the shelf, if you're not using something off the shelf at all that does that for you.
Usually don't support exceptions.
Exceptions is explicitly omitted from the embedded C++ specification. So there are definitely limitations, but for strict data initialization as opposed to code initialization, where the global variables are stored in the read write section of the element as opposed to the zero initialized, you can store things in the read write section of the L file. I'm not sure if this is answering your question.
I'm just curious. From what I remember in C, we do those kinds of initializations, but C doesn't have a constructor concept. So, in C, if you declare a little variable or declare an initializer on the variable, for lack of a better word, the stack, since they're all literals, because when you execute that function and when you initialize the program, those literals are pre-built.
Yeah, they're pre-filled by the application loader, by the ELF loader probably, and that's still the case here. The difference between the constructor thing and between calling constructors and just initializing the variables is that initializing the variables is simply a memory copy, whereas calling the constructor is actually code execution, and the code execution you need to build explicit support in for and chances are you haven't done that.
That's actually in the help support, or in the somewhere else in the folder?
Yeah, usually you'd be loading an help file or
yeah.
file. It'll be in my folder.
Compilation environment doesn't support specific sections.
That's pretty much right, yeah. I mean, you can build them in. One of the things I'm going to get to later is that because I consider embedded development kind of a continuum with open development, you can pretty much throw hardware at a system and keep on increasing the existing software load that you require to run until the point where it's basically indistinguishable from an open system as far as the facilities provided the software. That isn't what I'm focusing on. I'm trying to focus in this talk on things that you can't rely on, so that you can write code that can target lots of different embedded platforms, including ones where the output would be much more limited. Okay. Where was it? In fact, speaking of that. Yeah, there aren't any system facilities that you can really think of for which you can say that it definitely will exist on every embedded system. A lot of important processors like GPUs, I'm not sure about for example, the cell processor has one PPC as well as 8 subordinate processors, and the subordinate processors, I don't know if they support full C compiler, but there are important processors for which even a C compiler isn't available. We don't really worry too much about that in our applications. As I was saying before, if you're building an embedded device, any limitation in the system facilities that you expect to exist and your ability to build the device can be worked around basically by throwing hardware at the problem. That, you know, if you can't work without a full Linux environment, you can make a full Linux environment runnable on an embedded platform, and you'll be able to build your device in this form. But trying to target software for a wide variety of embedded systems, including ones that you don't control, the variations in platform capabilities are quite a bit more difficult to manage. The constraints on interfaces to the rest is, for example, if you have separated address spaces, different processes that talk to each other, that don't talk to each other, that doesn't necessarily exist. If you do use it, then the constraints on communications between the processes are necessarily more stronger than the constraints if you're living within the same address space. You can't just dereference a pointer and expect it to work. But at the same time, it improves the system stability if you do have separate address spaces that can't scribble over each other. So you still want to support such environments when they exist. The question then is how do you write software that can run optimally in a large variety of environments? And the first thing I suggest doing is to refactor your code so that your system requirements, or so that basically different parts of the code that we refactor the code so that according to the requirements that the code has on the system. The second thing that I suggest doing is to try and minimize the requirements that your code has for the system. Now, I'm going to have an example here. At Arcados, most of the important products that we produce at the moment include an audio playback function. It's the last step in software audio processing. As the last step in audio playback, we write samples that are decoded to a FICO that feeds the hardware I2S interface. What you're looking at here is kind of a mock-up of what I think is a perfectly reasonable interface to talk to a hardware audio device. There's the audio device context structure. It has an initializer and a reset function.
Can you increase the font size or something?
Do you know how to do that with Emacs? This is Aquamax. I'm not really sure how to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you got a custom on it. Sorry.
You should do it from one of the menus.
Yeah. preferences, any of them.
Well, you know what, it's not really an important problem. I could just assume avoid the problem, because it's not really the important thing that I'm trying to emphasize. I'm sorry?
It's not like it's a back of class, maybe.
Okay. I mean, I guess we consider this a more or less reasonable interface to talking to a FIFO, but it's pretty much a direct register interface that is intended to take care of things like creating a hard association between a sample that's read or written and the time at which that sample will enter or leave the playback engine. But other than that, it really doesn't do that much. It's not a very advanced interface. But the problem with using an interface like this is that usually, you know, if you consider MP3 audio, each MP3 frame that you decode has 1,152 stereo samples, generally speaking. A typical FIFO size in the hardware is something like 256 samples, so you really don't have enough. You don't have enough room in the FIFO to be able to store an entire decoded frame of MP3, but you get the entire decoded frame of MP3 all at once. So in order to ensure that the FIFO stays at a reasonable level, you need to have FIFO management software in your. You need to include FIFO management in your audio interface. There are a couple of different approaches you can take to. You can take to including the FIFO management in the audio device or with the audio playback engine. If you correctly point out that it's very unlikely that you ever have little enough audio to play FIFO management, be nothing necessary. In other words, the FIFO management is always necessary every time you talk to the audio device. Then you might conclude that you should include the FIFO management directly in the audio device driver. It seems easier to work with. All the code is in one place. You can easily fix. You know, if you want to work with the audio, it's easy to look up what you need to do. I actually tend to disagree with this philosophy for reasons that you might have guessed. The FIFO management is the hardware device is a system requirement for the audio interface. However, the FIFO management logic can be usefully separated from the hardware being managed, and performing separation has a number of advantages. I think I missed a slide. Sorry, guys. You can test the FIFO management much more aggressively when it's separated from the hardware. The hardware debugging environment is really poor relative to the development PC, so the more that you can debug on the development PC, the better off you are. So if you do require the hardware FIFO engine in order to debug the stuff that keeps the FIFO non-empty, then you necessarily have a less good debugging environment. The development environment tends to be pretty bad for producing edge cases, but with a code coverage analysis tool or something along those lines, you can easily. Make sure that you've covered all the edge cases in your regression tests. You're more flexible with the buffering scheme you use when you don't include the FIFO management with the audio device. When you don't include the buffer management, and you don't strongly couple the buffer management library to the audio playback hardware. The hardware also becomes more testable. You can reproduce hardware problems much more easily when you can replace a lot of the software in racks with the hardware with test harnesses. And the last and most important point is that it insulates the software from those hardware modules most likely to exhibit problems. Your ARM core will most likely execute instructions according to spec, but if you're building a custom audio interface, chances are at some point during development there will be some bugs. And hopefully not, but it's possible that by the time you actually produce the chip with that custom hardware, some bugs will remain. And if you want to work around those bugs, it's best to have to work around those bugs in a smaller. It's best to have the area in which you need to work around those bugs to be as small as possible. This leads directly into what I consider the most difficult part of developing embedded applications compared to desktop and server applications, which is that it's very difficult to isolate bugs. For one thing, it's basically impossible to single step through hardware in the way that we're used to doing in software. Hardware developers have really good simulators. These simulators basically record each step, and you can analyze them. And you can analyze exactly what the state transitions were in the hardware at any point. But they're extremely slow. You know, they're basically emulating each bit flip of each part of the hardware on each clock edge. You consider a gigahertz processor, that's a billion clock edges every second, and a complicated part with a lot of transistors in it. That there are a lot of transistors that can change state. I mean, that's a lot of operations that you need to simulate. Simulating a few milliseconds of operational time can take a few weeks in a good hardware simulator. The software debuggers tend not to be very easy to use, like I already mentioned. The software environments are so limited that the debuggers may not be available, may be impractical. I think in our experience, the best way of isolating hardware and software problems is through lots and lots of logging of the hardware and software state. Now, in order to log the hardware state, there are a couple of techniques that you can use, one of which is to pull the register for the software and log the contents of those registers using the same logging facilities that are available to the software. Outside the lab, this is the only thing you can do. Inside the lab, you can use one of these, which is what we call a logic analyzer, and what it is, basically, we have a bunch of cables here that are attached to debug ports on the development board. The development board exposes the FPGAs, which are basically a faster reprogrammable way of compiling hardware, but a lot more expensive than a chip would be. A lot more expensive individually than an individual chip, but a lot easier to produce initially. These FPGAs expose their internal state across debugging pins. The logic analyzer reads the voltage level on the debugging pins to figure out whether it's a 1 or a 0, assembles the contents of those debugging pins into numbers that it displays in a relatively logical way. What you're seeing here is a waveform as it's presented to the hardware of the power line communications packet. It's very similar to the sort of data that you see in an oscilloscope. Software logging techniques, also pretty difficult, but what you'll tend to notice is that the complexity of the software that you need to log tends to require more advanced logging facilities, and more advanced logging facilities enable more complicated software. For example, the first application that we tested on it with the AI-100 chip basically flashed a bunch of toggled a bunch of GPIOs at different rates, and these GPIOs were attached to LEDs, so we would be able to see if the LEDs were blinking in the appropriate fashion, whether the software was running more or less correctly. Soon after that, we attached a serial console. We made the serial console work, the serial port work, and then that enabled us to get enough logging information to be able to continue bringing up the system, porting the hardware drivers that we had written for the FPGA platform, et cetera, to the final chip. And eventually we added telnet support and IP stack. You can tell that into the console on our chips when they're compiled in debugging mode. Have access to all the data that we stored about the state of the system as it operated. I fully expect that we're continuing to develop our logging facilities, and For example, one thing we added recently was, or one thing that we added recently was a way of capturing all the transitions, or all the, capturing a bunch of logging messages into a buffer that, and then waiting for an event trigger that would cause us to dump this data out to the telnet console or to the serial port, which allowed us to get a lot more detail than we possibly could have on exceptional conditions when on the inputs that led to those, on the inputs that led to those types of errors. I think to sum up, what I'd like to say is that you really do need good development practices in order to fully exploit an embedded system. You probably don't really worry about making your software embeddable yourselves. But if you do worry about it, you'll find that your code is quite a bit better because of it. You've isolated the things that work with the unreliable boundaries from the core of the application that you can test very well and make very reliable in a pretty rigorous way. If there are unexpected things that happen at the edge, then they can be dealt with more or less easily at the edge, without affecting your core. The code that results tends to be a lot more reusable. It's easier to port, easier to test, easier to understand. It's basically cleaner. I sort of think of it like haiku. The extreme constraints of the form force you to find a kind of purity in order to write effectively. Or at least, I'm told that that's what haiku is like. I guess that's it.
Thanks, Greg.
We are hoping to, you can check our website to see what our progress is. We're hoping to be expanding again in the future. What other questions?
One question about initial loading of our software. Do
embedded
developers still use things like Motorola S records and Intel X and all that stuff?
I have used those things. They're used, for example, in Flash programmers. The Flash programmer can read the Intel S record format and download code to the Flash, to a Flash part, like a NOR Flash part, which you can then solder onto your board, or which you can stick into a Flash socket, and depending on your software and how the hardware platform works, it may need to start executing directly out of Flash, our AI100 chip does, or there may be a ROM that boots to Flash. But yeah, their S records are sometimes used for doing initial programming of Flash parts. Yes?
Can you give an example of some software that you developed, presumably with these good practices, that you were then able to use in a modular fashion on, say, two different hardware systems? For those of us who never come close to dealing with a chip, maybe an example would be helpful.
Well, for example, we have a WMA decoder library, which was provided to us by a particular vendor. And the vendor gave us, actually, I'm describing this pretty well. I mean, obvious examples would be, for example, threading support, scheduler primitives, things like I want to wait a millisecond, I want to wait 30 milliseconds. We have portability chains that allow us to compile code that calls this sort of thing on the host and on the PC as well as on the embedded platform. We at this point try very hard to make it so that any new development on the embedded platform can also be run on the PC on which we're doing the development, primarily for reasons of the debugging environment. But it's useful in its own way as well. You know, we have custom IP protocols for doing things like firmware upgrades, and we want to be able to run the same IP protocol on the host as we do on the target platform, even though we use that API on the target platform for interacting with IP is different than the one that that exists on the host, so we insert a change for doing that. Does that answer your question? Yes.
You're talking about, you know, firmware upgrades. Would you have like a standard system you use across a bunch of different platforms, or would you have to rewrite it sometimes?
Well, we mostly have the same. We have a protocol, and the protocol is theoretically be portable to different. We have actually several protocols that would all be portable to different underlying firmware storage mechanisms. In our current part, we pretty much always use NOR flash, and we always write to that. But we have used it. We have other backing things for it. Storage mechanisms for test, for example, we can write to a memory copy of the flash the main point though is that the protocol does not make any assumptions about the underlying storage mechanism, so it's theoretically lots of different storage mechanisms would work.
Do you have to write your own operating system for this, or do you utilize some underlying operating system or components
thereof? We use one called MicroCOS, which I have read all of the source code to, and it's very comprehensible. I would not undertake reading the entire source code to something like NetBSD or FreeBSD, but it's easily possible to read. Rather, it would take a much longer time to read through the entire source base of the NetBSD or FreeBSD kernel. It took me probably 2 or 3 weeks to read through the source code base of the scheduler that we use. I don't like to use the word operating system, honestly, on our chip because the facilities of the scheduler device are so primitive. We don't have a lot of things that you expect of an operating system. I have done some custom code on it. I was involved in porting the operating system to our particular chip. The ARM port that we have for the operating system had a problem on our chip because our chip didn't support a particular kind of return from interrupt that the port relied upon. So I needed to work around that.
Anything? So I have a question about the logic analyzer.
Sure.
For people who say they want to tinker with an embedded device, say something that they purchased or found or whatever, that they want to learn more about. You know, is there any way that an average person could find one of these analyzers that you have and use it, or is it like a fairly exotic piece of hardware that's going to...
Mike, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but these are exotic and expensive pieces of hardware. There are other things that you can do, depending on what your requirements are. I think that it'd be possible to attach a multimeter to things. You know, if you want to work with just a single GPIO at a time, that's not that hard to work with. But the logic analyzer is extremely useful, but it's also extremely esoteric. It's also extremely expensive and esoteric.
Who
makes it? One uses from Tektronix. I believe there are other manufacturers.
Do you have another question?
Sure.
Do you find that you reuse, let's say, code from BSD install when you're working?
The ID stack that we use is pretty much derived from the BSDs. I think ported some BSD code to the application. But one thing you notice working with BSD code is a lot of reliance on global variables aren't as harmful. In a lot of simple shell commands, for example, because you don't expect two concurrent instances of cat to be running in the same process. Cat can use lots of global variables, but we're not allowed to. We don't have address space separation. We don't have a good loading mechanism. We really can't do that sort of thing very easily. So a lot of the BSD code, I think, just isn't directly portable. It's a lot of work.
Am I misunderstanding? CPU is based on the ARM, is that correct?
That's right.
And is it a modern enough ARM where you could say run
yes.
a full-fledged?
Yes.
Is there any limitation as to why you wouldn't follow that sort of path to say, you know, let's run a full NetBSD install or a full Linux install or something else?
Well, one reason not to do that has to do with the real-time constraints of our, for example, power line communications driver. We have a lot of the stuff in the software there that needs to respond within very small number of microseconds to events that occur on the power line. And incorporating a full-fledged kernel, integrating that sort of thing into a full-fledged kernel would be very likely to work. There are techniques available to do that sort of thing. We're looking at virtualization right now for being able to have a low level will respond very quickly to problem events while still being able to have as kind of a user process a full NetBSD or Linux or something else kernel.
Do you have a
MMU
on the
bar? I'm sorry?
Do you have an MMU?
We do have an MMU.
So page man?
In theory, we could.
But you don't do that.
We don't do it.
Okay. No. Uniform Cisco addresses?
Actually, no. The reason it used to be uniform memory, but we switched away from that because on the ARM, branch instructions change size, or rather the amount of data that's associated with a branch instruction to call a function changes size depending on the amount of space you need to branch to, and our physical memory was too far, some parts of our physical memory were too far away from other parts in order to make those branches as efficient as possible. So we do use some remapping in order to reduce the size of the branch instructions and the data, and not have to do a data load from parts of the system that are extremely.
You
scribbled
or something? So you said that you don't have memory protection.
We don't have memory protection. I think one of our engineers has put in some memory protection, but it's actually pretty difficult to do in our environment because there is no gap between code and data. Data is right adjacent to code, and the smallest page size that you can easily get, I forget whether it's 1K or 4K, but that's still too close in some of our system critical memory for us to be able to use memory protection on that bit of memory. And that's also the most important bit of memory to use memory protection again, because that's around address zero where all the straight pointers or writes will probably occur.
I mean, I know you could do stuff with coroutines. Is that an option, or is it just a design choice, or do you like scheduling and stuff like that?
Can you explain a little bit better? I'm not sure if that is.
Instead of then having an operating system, you could do a lot of the concurrency using coroutines. Is that something
that
you would do, like, simpler stuff, or if you want to do something pretty involved, you might as well just
apply
an operating system like
MicroC? MicroC isn't really much of an operating system, to point that out. But we do have a lot of asynchronous callbacks. In fact, that's the major. We use threads, but we try and avoid requiring threads by using a lot of asynchronous callbacks and directing each thread. The callback is handled in. It's possible to run every callback in the same thread pretty easily. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's random.
Sorry, I'm not sure I followed. Anything else?
Just to back to my question, the coroutines in general tend to require a lot of state savings between the swap back. I don't know how much of a win coroutines are over threads, except that they're not a kernel concept, so you don't have a lot of the kernel overhead, like Cisco and so forth. We have scheduled, you get something there, but you still have a lot of working with restate. Do you have a
free programming environment where you can allocate n variables on a stack? I assume there is a stack. and you have to restore it all the variables, you start to run into the wall of hard real time constraints.
Actually, this is actually, if I understand the point, I think we kind of approximate this because we don't put that much on the stack. Mostly we put state inside of contact structures, and the contact structures are passed through these asynchronous callbacks. Basically, every time that there's something that would block, or not every time, depending on the library that we're using, but we encourage every time something that would block, instead of blocking, the callback will be called when the operation completes. And the fact that all the state is stored inside the context structure kind of means that you don't rely on the stack on the stack before.
So by context structure, you mean something like an activation log and use the footers?
Something like that, but you know, we use C, it's much more explicit.
Right.
All right, if there's anything else.